Seems like all the key players are weighing in on the healthcare debate. You have your politicians, your insurance companies, your hospitals, your pharmaceutical companies, and now we have the theater. And my guest today interviewed over 300 people, finding out how they view their health, their doctors, their healthcare system. And she had to weed through all these hundreds of people, and she chose 20 of those interviews. And she turned them into a documentary-style theater production now on Broadway called Let Me Down Easy. And in it, she performs 20 interviews. I mean, she performs these interviews, and she embodies each person's speech patterns, their body movements. If you know who these people are and you recognize some of them, you really see how well she does it. She has an injured bull rider to a doctor in New Orleans during Katrina, and it's really a cross-section of our country on this controversial issue. And she brings the thoughts and the feelings of people from all different backgrounds onto the stage. And now she's in here with us in our studio. And some of her characters have things to say that you're surprised to hear that they would say these things. And sitting next to me is Anna Deavere Smith. She's a playwright and actress. You can see her as the hospital administrator and Showtime's Nurse Jackie, as well as a professor at New York University. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you.
Great to be here.
Why this project? What made you undertake this project?
Well, I should just correct one fact that actually the second stage is off-Broadway.
Not on Broadway.
But it's all
legally,
right in the same
right,
48th
right.
and 8th, same thing, area. Well, I was invited as far back as the late 90s to go to the Yale School of Medicine and to make a project in which I interviewed doctors and patients in what's called Medical Grand Rounds. Mm-hmm. And for Medical Grand Rounds, to perform at Medical Grand Rounds, which is really a lecture series for doctors. And it was a really extraordinary experience that I didn't actually do until 2000. But as long ago as 2000, I started thinking about these issues just because talking to patients in particular was a very rich experience, since what I've been doing since the early 80s is collecting talk, just
right.
really interesting talk. And when something has happened to someone to compromise their health, they often have a lot to say, and it's very interesting to hear.
And so this is really very topical right now.
That's
all
right.
The stuff that you were portraying on the stage there.
Yeah.
And I when I watched these 20 people that you portray, and I knew that you interviewed 300, I'm saying to myself, how do you weed out the other 280?
Well, that's the...
Isn't that always the biggest problem?
It's always the hugest problem with all of my work. Some of your listeners probably saw my play Twilight Los Angeles, which was about the Los Angeles riots. And again, I had over 300 interviews, and I had to somehow whittle it down to an evening of theater.
1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to talk with Anna Deavere Smith. Who do you have a favorite?
Mom, oh, no,
no.
No,
there's no favorite. It's like ask which is your favorite kid.
Yeah, you can't. My mother had five, and she never went down that road. That's not a very good idea.
But was there an overriding theme that you found?
Well, yeah, I think that the overriding theme really is stated in the beginning of the play, that it's about every single person in the play has something that they love about their life.
Right.
And has a relationship to possibly losing that very thing. So I think that this play is about love and death. It's
right.
about love and loss. It's about the resilience of the human spirit, the vulnerability of the body, and the price of care.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to see if we can get right into one.
Okay.
If you want to choose one. How about Phil Pizzo?
Okay. So Phil is the dean of the Stanford University School of Medicine. And you want me to do the whole thing?
Yeah, if you can. Okay, we have about 6 minutes till the break.
Okay, great. Okay, so this is called, and I give everything a title because I think people deserve to have their sections mm-hmm. titled. And this is called Developing Nation. What I fear is happening is that we are slipping into a healthcare system that looks very much, will look very much, unless it's changed dramatically, like that of a developing nation. Well, think about it. This simple fact, the survival projections on a worldwide basis are much higher than they've been in the past, but those can be radically changed by a couple of significant factors. One of them, which is preventable, is the epidemic of obesity. You know, obesity in its own right will engender the evolution and development of so many other morbid diseases that it can erode much of the progress that's been made in survival and longevity up until now. And secondly, we have the emergence of new infectious diseases that challenge us year in and year out, and those two will make a tremendous difference. The whole focus right now on healthcare reform is largely an economic one, but underlying that is a huge set of views and expectations. The whole difficult challenge, if you will, of rationing or regulating health care is going to have to be a part of the public debate. We spend a significant portion of our health care dollars on the last 6 or 8 months of life, right? That'd be all right if it led to success, but the fact that it simply results ultimately in death and sometimes with as many complications as benefits is a really important part of this dialogue. You know, when I hear the debate go on from members of our Congress, they'll say, well, I don't want you to tell me what my grandmother should get or what my mother should get. But the reality ultimately is that each of us have to make some decisions about that. We do it in a way on an individual level, and then we slip into a kind of a slippery slope with one parent or a child or a loved one saying, do this, when in fact the doing it isn't going to result in any true long-term benefit. What are our expectations of what constitutes reasonable care at really both ends of the age spectrum is going to have to be a part of this public debate because it tracks right back to the economics and what we're going to spend. I think that the discussion has to begin by a significant cultural frame shift, which is really quite encompassing. You know, in addition to being a pediatrician, I'm also an oncologist. There was a study that was done just a couple of years ago that asked if oncologists, how often did they introduce to their patient that they were at the end of known therapy? Rare. Rarely done. Rarely does the dialogue take place that, you know, we have expended a reasonable or a reasoned amount of treatment and we need to move towards comfort and care. And I think that's a cultural phenomenon that doesn't exist throughout the world. I mean, you've traveled the world, Anna, and you know how people talk about death and dying in other societies. It's different than we do it here. The kind of discussion that I describe that a doctor may need to have with her or his patient about death and dying may be one that a medical student or even a resident never has organized supervision around. Shocking, isn't it? Shocking. And I think that there are probably at least two or more reasons why this doesn't happen as much as it should. One is the lack of skill and sophistication. The other is, in some ways, a concern that if you begin to move towards that discussion, you're taking away hope from a patient. And then a third one, which is a hard one for me to say, but I think nonetheless represents an honest reflection, is that it takes a lot of time.
Very nice. Anna Deavere Smith reading a little bit from her play, or one woman show, Let Me Down Easy, on Science Friday from NPR News. And you use this, doctor, to say things that people don't want to say. Talk about end-of-life issues.
Well, I went to talk to him because he's one of the most eloquent and passionate people, actually, that I've met on the subject, and he has actually been in the play for a long time. I think it's very interesting how he starts, that if we don't do something about this, something dramatic about it, that we're headed right towards a healthcare system that's going to look like a developing nation. I think it's very hard for us to imagine that as Americans.
And he says we need to make these difficult choices.
And one of the dramatic things we have to do is make difficult choices. And I think we see how nearly impossible it is for politics to be the site. As much as we need politics to frame this discussion and to put it on the table for us, we see that we can't imagine that these tough conversations are really going to happen in a political way.
But they'll happen in the theater.
In theaters and places like that, schools.
Schools, and people will come away from your performance and say, this is something we can talk about
that. Well, I'm glad you think that way.
1-800-998-2555. We're going to come back and talk lots more. Take your phone calls. We're also tweeting on at SciFry, at SCIFRI. And we're going to talk about Let Me Down Easy. And we'll talk about why you chose the name for that play. It's quite interesting. I saw how you did it. With Anna DeVere Smith. You know her from Nurse Jackie. You haven't seen her here on Off-Broadway. Maybe she'll be touring somewhere. The play will go on the road. We never know. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour with actress and playwright Anna DeVere Smith about her one-woman show about health in our country. And it's a terrific play. It's called Let Me Down Easy. It's at the Second Stage Theater in New York. It's running through the 6th of December.
That's right.
Any plans to go on the road, take it around?
We're looking at that. I'd love to.
Yeah.
I'd love to.
That's great. We hope, because we have lots of actors, actresses, producers, directors coming through here who are off-Broadway, either at that your theater or Ensemble Studio Theater, these other places where these great little plays happen, and then they have trouble getting out to the rest of the public.
Mm.
So we're hoping for you.
Well, thank you.
Let's go to the phones because we have lots of people who would like to talk to you. Let's go to Kathleen in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. Did I get that right?
Hi. Yes, Bartlesville. Hi, Anna.
How are you?
I am great now. I have been a fan of yours since the late 90s. I attended a lecture you gave at Cincinnati Conservatory. I wanted to highlight two aspects of your work process. And the first being, as a musician myself, you said that the way in which you constructed each individual character was you would listen to the rhythm of their speech over and over, you know, when you're on the subway, whatnot, and it became almost like a percussive element in your development of a speech pattern. And I found that fascinating. And if you could elaborate on that. And then the other thing that one of the many things I took away from that evening was that you say that real communication begins when people get beyond grammar, which struck me because I'm the daughter of an English major, and but it's true, you know. And I just, are you going to be in New York still doing this in January?
No, but so you should get here by December.
Okay. Congratulations. I would love to hear, if any other aspects of the process. And you're on my short list of 10 people that inspire me.
So. Oh, well, that's nice. Well, you know, I think that part of language is music, that we are making music when we speak. And when I was a child, my grandfather said to me, if you say a word often enough, it becomes you. And my acting process is that simple. That's all it is talking to people, taking an excerpt of what they said and saying it over and over again with the idea of walking in a person's words the way you would walk in a person's shoes. And I think that rhythm is a part of that. And probably when we first start learning to talk, it has a lot to do with rhythm. I'm sure there's a linguist who can say it more eloquently than I can. I was just thinking today about how children learn mama first, and it's usually that they're taught mama rather than ma, right? I think with the idea that we're starting them down the track. And in fact, when people break their rhythmic patterns, in my experience, is when they really start to get to the good stuff of what they're saying, which may or may not be what I thought I was looking to hear.
Yeah. But it's too bad because we're on the radio, and she's such a great actress. Her body language is all missing from when she's reading it. It's this great body language on stage. You also, as part of your characterizations and the topics that you pick, is putting other people in other people's shoes.
Yeah.
It's having physicians being in other people's shoes that they never thought they might be in. And I'm thinking of the charity hospital segment where she believed she could give the poor the same treatment as the rich.
Right.
And she didn't understand what it meant to be poor until Hurricane Katrina.
Well, no, she understood what it meant to be poor before. This is an extraordinary young doctor who I met when I went to New Orleans right after Katrina, Kirsta Kurtz Burke, just a wonderful, wonderful human being. Went to Barnard, very advantaged Caucasian woman. And she loved working in a public hospital, as she said, because, you know, a lot of people work in public hospitals just for the training. We all know that, right? The poor patients, because learning is clumsy. the way she looked at working in a public hospital is, she says in the excerpt in the play, she goes, "But to me, you have a tremendous opportunity to see what it would be like, in some sense, without living it, to be poor and to open up your heart and your mind to these fantastic people coming into the hospital." What a fantastic way to think about things. Mm-hmm. And too rare in our country. It was that during Katrina, she worked as a doctor and been at charity, a public hospital, some say the oldest in America, or it was, it's now closed, for some time, with the belief that she could take care of poor people as well as she could take care of rich people. But being at charity during Katrina, and on the fifth day, still not being rescued, was a shocking thing to her, to see that her patients and the nurses just had to go on as if business was business as usual, making the best of flashlights when they had no electricity and 106 degrees and no food. This was an eye-opener to her, knowing very well that private hospitals had gotten the people out in private helicopters.
Yeah, it was. And that this whole thing of putting people in the other shoes that they would not normally be is part of the theme of the play. 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if I can get a question or two before I want to go to the cowboy. You'll hear about the cowboy. Jennifer in New York. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Anna. Thank you so much for your work. I'm a master's student in Columbia University's new narrative medicine program out of the medical school.
Great.
And I think one of the effects of this program will be changing medical education and medicine, and your work is a big part of our studies. And I have a question many of us had for you when we saw your show about how you prompt the people with whom you speak. How do you invite them to speak with you, and what questions do you ask them that elicits these stories?
Well, I try not to ask very many questions, because I think that narrative is an organic sort of a thing that we all have, like breathing. And part of getting to know who someone is to see how their narrative works. So in the case of one of the reasons, in fact, that this project became so interesting to me after I was at Yale was because I really only had to ask a patient one question to get some of the most beautiful language people spoke. They sang, they prayed. One man, his little granddaughter came in to read to me from her journal everything that she'd written when her grandfather was waiting for a heart transplant. And the simple question I asked each patient was just, "What happened to you?" And they had a lot to say. And, you know, in medicine, unfortunately, with the 15 minutes, I think it's rough. So that was really the beauty of this project, is it's one area of our existence that people will speak at great length about with not very much prompting.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. Before we run out of the time, because I will have some more time to talk, I want to do the monologue, Brent Williams, the rodeo bull rider, because he was a great surprise about what he had to say.
So this is called Toughness. "I got hung up by a bull, weighed over a ton. Wasn't a mean bull, but when I hit the ground, I was on my side, and he stepped on my left side of the two back feet, broke four ribs, L2, L3, and there was a guy, urologist for the hospital, was sitting in the front row when I got stepped on, and he came back, and he told me, 'Kid, you better go to the hospital.' He said, 'I bet you ruptured your kidney or your spleen or something.' And I said, 'Nah, I just broke some ribs.' He said, 'No, I'm serious. You need to get that checked out. I'm serious. I'm a urologist, military hospital.' He got on the phone. He called the hospital, and a civilian can only go to a military hospital if it's a life or death situation. And he called him. He told him it was a life or death situation. I was kind of laughing. I didn't believe him. Then they took me to Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas, made me piss in a cup, and I pissed straight red blood. Then they said they's going to take out my left kidney. I begged him. I said, 'Look, you know, I'm going to sit here. I'm going to ride bulls. If I only got one kidney, I'd just soon have two.' So they tried a new deal. They put a stent in there, and they saved half my kidney. So I got one and a half kidney instead of one. And them doctors, they get paid a flat rate. It's not like they're trying to rape me to make more money to pay their Mercedes-Benz bills, whatever they got. And I'll bet messing up most of them guys don't even drive them fancy sports cars like the other doctors do. Cost me a flat rate, $1,200. Yeah, $1,200, flat rate. Didn't matter if I got a CAT scan, whatever they did to me. It didn't change when I was in the ICU for 6 days. And then they took me to the next level. It didn't change. I didn't get no doctor's bills or nothing. And I was in there for 11 days. Everyone pays a flat rate no matter what it is. And personally, I think we need to go to a deal like that. And I think I have better doctors there. Doctors who really want to be doctors, not these days just go to college, spend all their parents' money going to college, come out and make a killing, don't really give a shit. You tell me a poor doctor and I'll kiss his. But we'll see what doctors really want to be doctors when there's not as much money in it. And them doctors, I felt like, well, they told me if I'd gone to any other hospital in San Antonio, if I'd been anywhere else, they'd just take my kidney out. Yeah, I have insurance. I have a family policy through Blue Cross of Idaho. $260 a month to cover all of us, like $7,500 deductible, which is stupid. We don't ever meet that. I mean, paying all this money and then, you know, because we got to pay $7,500 for them to meet it. I mean, all they do is rape us. It's just like all the people got the money. They rape the poor until they rape the middle class till the middle class becomes poor. And then they start raping the rich. And I mean, they're gonna break the country, I think. But basically, I'm an optimist. I say I'm an optimist. Yeah, well, you know, when you ride a bull and you do good and you ride him, I mean, you feel like, you know, there ain't nothing in the world that could probably, you know, beat you up or anything like that. You know, you just feel like life couldn't be better. You know, like this is what life's supposed to be. And it feels because, you know, there's so much power in it. You know, if you think about it, we shouldn't be able to stay on top of a bull that's trying to buck you off. Because, you know, we weigh like, you know, 150 pounds, you know, and they weigh like 2,000 pounds, you know, and, you know, I think the way you stay on top of a bucking bull is just determination. Well, I don't really want to think about it if I couldn't ride bulls. I mean, it'd just be like a big old empty space in me, I think. I mean, be all right. I have a ranch of my cows, but probably be like, maybe even bigger empty space than me and when like my brother died. And I don't know what it'll be like, you know, it's pretty big space, but I guess feel like when I'm done rodeoing, it'll probably be like, damn, my brother died, you know. Toughness? Well, we was in West Jordan, Utah. This bull shot my face right through the metal chutes, tore my face all up, and took 5 hours to sew me up, and next day they was going to straighten out my nose, and I had a rodeo that night, so I didn't want to put me under anesthesia, or however you say that word. I told them to do without it, and so when they straighten out your nose, they take these two metal rods and shove them up your nose, work their way up, and felt like it was going out through my brains, not the top of my head, and everybody said it should have killed me. They didn't even knock me out. But I have a high tolerance for pain, so guess that'd be toughness, but good thing about it was, once they straightened out my nose, I could breathe, and I couldn't breathe since I broke my nose in the high school rodeo.
That's great. That was great. This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato. We're listening to a monologue from Let Me Down Easy. He obviously was just the opposite of what you would have expected him to say. We need a flat rate.
Yeah.
Would never have. Did it surprise you when you heard?
He's a Republican. He's one of the most conservative of my friends. And I was surprised. I was very surprised that he came to that.
Wow. So where do you go from here with this? Do you hope that you can play forever, this play?
A repertory theater, so I won't be playing forever. I'd love to take it on the road. Like with my other plays, I'd love to be able to make a film of it.
Really?
You know, Twilight is still alive, as is Fires in the Mirror in schools. Mm-hmm. And I think that wouldn't have happened if there weren't a film that teachers can use to show their students. So I'd love to have that opportunity, too.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever think about rotating your other characters?
You know, I would love to. It would drive everybody crazy, like the stage manager wouldn't like that. The director would probably tear his hair out when he came to town. But I'd like to do a project where I can rotate characters, mm-hmm. so that may be what's mm-hmm. up for me next.
And do you hear from people who've seen this?
Oh, yeah.
It's affected their lives?
Well, that's interesting. I think that's a really interesting way to put the question. Everyone's invited, and almost all of the people in the play have seen it now. One very interesting person is Ruth Katz, who is been in the play. She's the oldest of the alums in the play, and I don't mean mm-hmm. by her age, but she was in the Yale medical school mm-hmm. version, and she's still in the play now. She's now working for Congressman Waxman. She did invite 150 of her friends and relatives from all over the country to come see it. Mm-hmm. And they were all there one Saturday night, so I imagine it has had some effect on her, and I was very pleased to meet everyone.
This must give you great satisfaction, this play.
Well, I love people, and I love ideas, and this kind of way of working that I've developed over many years mm-hmm. allows me to be in touch with all different kinds of people. I did interviews on 3 continents for this play, and it gives me ideas and people, and that's what I love the most.
I think the theater and a lot of the arts has great power. We can sit and debate, you know, Congress people and whatever, and debate the issues, but when you see it on the stage, you see a great film about it, there's much bigger power, greater power there to talk, to reach people.
Well, I think I really appreciate you giving a wonderful plug for the arts. We certainly need that plug right now in the country, given the fact that many nonprofit organizations, arts mm-hmm. organizations being nonprofit usually more often than not, are it's a rough time. I don't need to tell you that. But I think one of the things that the arts does is it messes up the lines. It doesn't look at things in terms of black and white. It's not just about winning and losing. You know, it was said to me that Thomas Jefferson could never be found in verbal undress. Mm. He had to watch everything he said. Every politician has to watch every word they say. We're given the liberty to say the wrong thing. And sometimes that's exactly what a public needs in order to have a point of entry into the conversation.
Well, we're very happy that you're here and that you did say those things on stage, and we hope for a long run, hope for an extended run, the film, whatever you'd like to make out of this play, because it's terrific.
Thank you for taking time. Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming into the studio today. Anna Deavere Smith is an actress, playwright. She wrote, produced Let Me Down Easy, and she's also a professor in the Tisch School of Arts at New York University, and it's at the Second Stage Theater in New York. It's running through December 6th. We hope it goes on the road. Thank you again for being with us today. That's about all the time we have today. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. And also surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We're podcasting and blogging and tweeting and twittering and everything else we can do on the internet that we can figure out how to get you involved with science. So we also have our video pick of the week. And Flora has it up there, and all our other videos. And we'd like to have your videos. If you have some great science videos you'd like to send to us, please do that. We welcome them. Don't forget, next week is our special, in a couple weeks, our Thanksgiving Day show. It's going to be up there next week, in which we talk about the Ig Nobels. Everybody loves to hear about the Ig Nobels, and that'll be on our special show that we do every year post-Thanksgiving. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week on MyRefLato in New York.